Hi, Michael Albert. Welcome to KABU.
Hi, thanks for having me.
In 1965, Michael Albert was studying physics at MIT. He got politically active in the civil rights and anti-war movements, got expelled from MIT, became a full-time activist, writer, co-founded South End Press and Z Magazine, wrote a slew of books, among them Pericon, which stands for Participatory Economics. It's subtitled Life After Capitalism. Also the book Practical Utopia Strategies for a Desirable Society. And he does a weekly podcast, Revolution Z, look for it on the web. Today we're going to talk about the current remarkable insurgency triggered by the murder of George Floyd and how all the anger and hope can be organized into struggle for life after capitalism. In a world living in harmony with natural ecosystems upon which our lives depend. So, Michael, you've written on those remarkable, in some ways historic features of the current uprising. Tell us about it.
As far as the uprising, I have never seen anything like it, and I'm not a youngster. I'm 73. And in my life, I've never seen anything that even comes close to the kind of sustained involvement coming from huge numbers of people and dispersed very, very widely across the country. So what marks this as quite unique and different is its duration, its intensity without flagging, and even more so, perhaps, that it isn't located, you know, in Washington and New York and San Francisco alone, but it's in all those kinds of places, but also far more widely spread into small towns and cities across the country. And that's a level of sustained activism that is markedly unusual.
Yeah, also, it seems to me how it's organized. It's so horizontal. There are groups all over Portland. When you look at the BLM website calendar, They're self-organized by people, not just in the central city and not, in fact, by the established groups, but in parks all over the city. There are picnics for Black Lives Matter that draw people and marches through the streets night after night.
It's even in small towns in some places. It remains to be seen, however, how long it can sustain itself if it doesn't develop a degree of infrastructure, a degree of shared demands and shared focus and shared methods across all those venues, across all those cities and states, to give it a degree of hope and a degree of learning. What's happening right now is that people are learning separately from one another. They're learning the experiences of organizing and of working together and of solidarity and also of the difficulties that arise. And to congeal that into lasting memories that people will be able to learn from is important, and then to be able to congeal it into some structure. In the 60s, we were very good at sort of what's happening now, widespread demonstrations, widespread activism, but we were not so good at, in fact, we were pretty poor, at having all of that energy and all of those lessons be embodied in a lasting movement, in a movement that would not die down, but would instead continue to grow and continue to diversify in its focuses. That we were not so good at. And that's the bane of my existence, that we didn't do better, because I think if we had done better, we'd be living in a different world now, different certainly than Trump and the garbage that we have. And so it's very important that this time around, in an upsurge that actually is wider than the 60s and more sustained, not than the 60s were over the years, but more sustained in its demonstrations than the 60s, but it needs to congeal into lasting commitments that are shared among all these people, and so that people don't sort of come to a point of exhaustion or come to a point of feeling like, oh, can we won some stuff and that's the end of it, but rather that it keeps growing and keeps demanding and moves on to talk about, you know, not just dealing with police violence, which is incredibly important, and not just dealing with systemic racism, which is even more important on a larger scale, but dealing with all of the vile attributes of contemporary society, the race and ethnic and cultural attributes, but also the gender and kinship attributes, the economic attributes, the political attributes, and begins to formulate some kind of a vision of a better society that we could live in.
This is Bill Resnick here at KABU Radio talking to Michael Albert, a longtime activist, writer, co-founder of Z Magazine. a podcaster on building a participatory society and economy. Michael, you've written a great deal on that participatory society and economy, and you've given examples. Why don't you first, let's talk about what it means, a participatory society, economy, and then we'll get into the examples. The examples that you choose, we surely can't go into all of them.
Well, the idea of participatory society is to think through what we would like a society to achieve for people. And once we have some degree of clarity about that, to try and think through what kinds of institutions could accomplish those goals that we have. So in other words, it's not just to say, well, we want freedom, we want justice, we want equity, we want people to be able to care about one another, we want people to be able to have fulfilling lives. It's to go further than that and to specify that a bit more and to then think about what kind of institutions are needed to accomplish those aims. So let's do the example of the economy, since that's the part that I've spent most time on, though I've spent a lot of time on the other parts as well. So regarding the economy, when I think about it, an economy affects how much stuff we have. It affects what kind of decisions we're able to make. It affects how we relate to one another. So I want to try and have some values, some aspirations around those things. So for the how much stuff we get, the aspiration that I have is for equity. And the idea there is there should be a fair amount of the social product for each person. And what determines what a fair amount is? Well, to my thinking, it's that people should get from the economy back for how much work they do, how hard they work, how long they work, the onerousness of the conditions under which they work. But they shouldn't get income because they own property. They shouldn't get income because they have more power than somebody else. They shouldn't even get income because they're more productive in the sense of having special talents or special skills. If we're lucky enough to get that at birth, then that's enough. We shouldn't be rewarded for it later. We should get income for duration, intensity, and onerousness of socially valued labor. And for decision making, it seems to me people should have a say in decisions to the extent that they're affected by them. In other words, if I'm more affected by something, I should have some more say in it. If I'm less affected, I should have some less say in it. And that's a norm that can be applied to everybody. It's called collective self-management. And I'm going quickly, but you also want people are going to interact with one another. They're going to have exchanges with one another. They're going to have attitudes toward one another. And you want an economy not to produce an environment that's dog-eat-dog, that's a rat race, in which people view each other as means to an end. You want an economy which produces an environment in which people's well-being depends on the well-being of others, in which for me to get ahead, you have to get ahead, and vice versa. So that instead of being opponents in a struggle in which one wins and one loses, we're sort of allies in a process in which all benefit. And if you take these kinds of norms and some more, I don't want to go on too long on your radio show. If you take these kinds of norms and you think them through, then you have to ask yourself, okay, what institutions do we want? Because to me, when somebody asks the left, well, okay, I get that you don't like racism. I get that you don't like sexism. I get that you don't like all these things. You say it so often, I get it, but what do you want? And the left is very poor at answering that question. Typically, the left can answer it in the short term. Well, we want a higher minimum wage. We want affirmative action. And it can answer it in terms of short-term reforms, which are valuable and good and part of a process of creating a new society. But what it has trouble doing is conveying to people a picture that's compelling and that is workable of a society that would yield all these desirable outcomes automatically of its own. Markets don't do that. The corporate division of labor doesn't do that. Profit-seeking doesn't do that. The kinds of institutions that we have, in other words, are contrary to our values. They're contrary to, you know, people being the most fulfilled, mutually supportive members of a social system that we could be. They're the exact opposite of that. They produce the opposite. So we want different institutions, and it's incumbent on us to explain what those institutions can look like, how they might function. Why? Two reasons. One, to provide hope, to provide motivation. And a second reason is so we can orient our strategy to attain what we're trying to attain. When we look at the history of the left, we notice that sometimes incredibly well-meaning incredibly courageous, incredibly industrious and energetic people have in fact caused transitions not to what they really mostly wanted, not to their aspirations, but to other things instead that were much less desirable and sometimes even undesirable. And so we need vision both for motivation and to orient our activities. And the kinds of work that I and people like me do on things like participatory economics or participatory society are trying to provide that kind of contribution.
Let's get to some of those institutions, what they would look like struggles in healthcare. What should we be fighting for in terms of reforms, and how that fight for reforms can also prefigure and show us what we're really and fight for what we're really asking for, which is a good healthcare system. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Michael Halbert. He's been talking about the potentials for this insurgency that we really have to sort of crystallize the struggle and the ideals that it represents into a vision of the future that we can actually work for in the many movements. Michael, in Practical Utopia Strategies for a Desirable Society, you do talk about other examples. I know you have your ecology chapter is called your Participatory Ecology. And I know you've dealt with energy systems. Tell us about what kind of energy system you imagine.
Well, there's two different issues here when you talk about energy in society. One is technical. Where does the energy come from? What kinds of sources are employed? And the other is social. How is it organized and how is it distributed? So the technical one is technically complicated, but it's not politically complicated. You want to use energy sources that are as free of pollution and as sustainable as possible for obvious reasons. I mean, this couldn't be much more elementary. You don't want to use up stuff that you've become dependent on, and you don't want to create a mess. And so movements have gravitated toward solar and wind, water, to use these sources in a manner which is conducive to sustainability, to not despoiling the atmosphere and the ground. That part is for, I think, engineers and ecological scientists and then movements to win. The other part of the issue, though, which is distribution, if you will, is very different. And that's like the whole rest of the economy. What is the appropriate way to think about, or the caring and humane way to think about, energy? Well, given a certain amount of energy, should it be used on things that are of benefit only to a very few people? Should huge amounts of energy go to pursuits that benefit relatively few people? And when it's put that way, the answer is no. And as soon as you put it that way and you answer it no, you begin to realize, well, maybe we should do something about the gigantic stores of energy that are wasted on producing weapons that, thank God, are never used. It would be even worse if they were used. On producing transportation systems that are about as insane as they could be. In other words, cars, which are very energy inefficient and which despoil the atmosphere, one per family or two per family in some cases, or even three in some cases. These little vehicles moving around in the most inefficient way one could imagine instead of a public transportation system and a sensible construction of, for that matter, cities and towns. And, you know, you can go on through these things, but I honestly think they are not the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter, at least in my mind, of these kinds of issues is how we socially organize. So, for instance, you mentioned healthcare. The easy answer is, well, there should be free healthcare for everyone. Okay, we're done with that. But that's not quite all there is to it. Who delivers that healthcare? So let's take a hospital. If we consider a hospital now, first of all, they're profit-oriented. They're privately owned, many of them, most of them. They're privately owned. They pursue profits. That means they do all kinds of procedures and operations that have very little to do with healthcare, that are cosmetic and the like, to make money. They charge fortunes, way more than the cost of production warrants. Why? Because they have bargaining power, because people's lives are at stake. That's like pharmaceutical companies. So all those kinds of attributes which make it top-heavy for the rich and the powerful who benefit from the process and meanwhile those with less means get poor care or oftentimes no care and suffer from the process. So those kinds of things have to be eliminated. But let's look even more closely. Let's suppose we go inside of a hospital and we look at it not from the point of view of the patient, but from the point of view of the people who work there. So we have doctors and nurses and people who clean the place up. And let's just take those three for a moment. Those are starkly different. The situation of the different workers in the hospital is very different. It isn't just that somebody owns it who's outside the hospital and pocketing the profits. That's horrible. So that has to go. So that's what we mean by getting rid of private ownership. But what about dividing up the workforce so that about 20% does all the empowering tasks, has better circumstances, and earns way more? And 80% has more rote tasks, more repetitive tasks, tasks that are disempowering, that exhaust and diminish their ties to others and diminish their knowledge of the workplace. So the 20% is above the 80%. The 20% is a kind of a class above the 80%. 80% workers, 20% coordinator class. For me, the answer regarding healthcare, transportation, schooling, whatever you want to talk about, leads back inexorably to underneath the class relations and the gender relations and the racial relations. And it's those dynamics that have to be solved in order to solve those particular industries, the energy disposition also. So in the hospital, in the workplace, in the factory, wherever, what we have to do is create an environment that is conducive to people having self-managing say, to people being able to participate in the decisions that affect their lives, to people having a fair share of the income, which means for duration and onerousness and intensity of work. Notice, if we rewarded according to that norm right now in hospitals, the people who clean the place up would probably make the most money. And that makes sense, because if it wasn't for power, that would be the job that you would have to pay people the most to do, because it's the least fulfilling. All right, so the point here is that when we look at any area of life, we have to sort of address these broader, deeper issues if we want to develop a real vision. Take education. As long as it's the case that 20% do all the empowering work and 80% do rote and mechanical work where they're basically just taking orders, then the school system has to produce people in some sense who expect that and who are acclimated to that. And that's why, if you think about high school when you were in it a long time ago for me and you, but people think about it, you can remember that for some people, the school day is terribly onerous. And as the end of the day comes, they're sort of looking at the clock. And they're praying for those last 15 minutes to go by so they can get the hell out of the school. And then there are other people who enjoy school and who are benefiting from it. And what's the difference? It's not that they're genetically different. It's that school is structured so that 20% will become empowered and will run the show, and 80% will become acclimated to enduring boredom and taking orders. And that's, what is that part of? It's not a function just of the attitudes of teachers, much less the attitudes of students. It's rather a function of the way the whole economy is organized. That's what it needs. And so it puts pressure on the school system to deliver that. And the school system comes through. So if we want to move from vision to demands, or vice versa, we have to get a clarity about what are the real causes of the real injustices and pain that people endure, what are the structural solutions to that, and then what kind of demands can move us toward that.
Michael Albert, I want to thank you. We have to talk again about how hospitals and schools and every institution can be structured such that no job is a terrible job, that people have the opportunity and feel a sense of need to, in fact, be able to take on more responsible tasks and tasks that give them a sense of creativity and possibility. It seems to me it's not just paying people with the worst jobs more. It's eliminating every one of those worst jobs, giving people a capacity to do the menial jobs in the morning and do carpentry in the afternoon, which is an enormously creative job, and then go to the opera or whatever, concerts, or make your own music in the evening. Michael Albert, Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.